from KQED's Snap Studios.
This is
A Tiny Plot.
Nation, I cannot wait for you to hear this epic journey Snap producer Shayna Sheely has been on. Shayna has followed a small group of homeless people in Oakland as they fight for an extraordinary new idea and they speak for themselves. It's an epic story we'll be releasing over the next few weeks in a series of 5 installments. From KQED's Snap Studios, welcome to A Tiny Plot, Chapter 1, The Barricade. Contains strong language and graphic imagery. Sensitive listeners, please be advised. Shayna Sheely takes us back to where it all started.
Years ago, a man with sharp blue eyes and a sea of long wavy hair came upon a park along an estuary called Union Point.
I heard a little bit of serenity, I guess.
His name was Eddie. He walked around alone, mostly barefoot, surveying the land.
It was like a park, a kid's park with a marina.
There were 2 empty parking lots, grassy lawns, benches, and bathrooms. Sailboats off in the distance. Waves from the bay lapping up onto a little sandy shore.
It was full of rocks and rusted metal and corroding metal and stuff and broken glass and just garbage everywhere.
This park seemed to him like one of the less bad places to sleep in Oakland. He saw it as a fixer-upper. Lots of potential for someone with a vision.
It smelled like garbage with a hint of sulfur.
He started sleeping there. At first, just out in the open.
Were you scared ever to be there alone?
Yeah, because of the raccoons. Raccoons are fierce animals, man. They can tear you up if they wanted to.
Really?
That's why I decided to put up a tent.
Once his tent was up, Eddie built out his space. He found an old wood stove and built fires in the empty parking lot at night.
I like to watch the moon. Wherever I was at, whatever I was doing, you know, I could just glance over, keep my eye on it and watch it.
One day, he found a rusted-over ship anchor half buried in the ground, nearly as tall as him. He cleaned it and painted it, red, white, and blue. He'd always been an artist, working with his hands. And when he was in his 60s, he had a stroke and his tent. And he never got back the full use of his hands.
Same problem. I can't hold on to things. They fall out of my hands. And it's pretty frustrating.
But he still made these walking sticks out of tree roots from around the park that he carved and finished. Sometimes he painted them gold. And he really fixed up Union Point Park. In the beginning, he was all alone.
Then other people started showing up. I ran into some friends of mine, and I told them about the park, and they came down. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know.
And what kind of people came to Union Point?
Homeless people.
They came to the park with tents and blankets and cars. A lot of them wanted to work with Eddie to make things better. Eddie would wake up in the afternoon, and together they'd walk down to the shoreline, which was full of trash.
Every day. And little bit by little bit, we pulled it all up out of there to make a beach on that stretch of land over there. Pretty nice beach.
Eddie and others were sharing that beach with more and more people. More tents popped up in the parking lot near Eddie's. They spilled into the second lot, and then out to the side of the park along the railroad tracks. To the parents who dropped their kids off at the school nearby, and the boat owners with sailboats docked just yards away. This was a problem. And it was a sign of a bigger crisis. Of over 100,000 people sleeping in the middle of sidewalks and underpasses and public parks all across the state of California. A humanitarian emergency. About one-third of our country's homeless population is here in California. Before I met Eddie, before I even knew about Union Point Park, I'd heard homelessness here in California described as this big ship that's been on course for decades. And anyone who has any sort of power is trying everything they can think of to turn the ship around. But the ship is too big. It's been at sail for too long, picking up speed and runaway polarization of wealth, systemic racism, and policies preventing new housing from being built. There are now close to 6,000 people on the streets each night in Oakland alone.
An audit in the city of Oakland found that the city is not prepared to deal with the homeless crisis.
Shortly after Eddie's arrival at the park, the city of Oakland would directly and indirectly spend over $120 million per year, trying to, one, make life less awful for homeless people, and two, get them to stop setting up tents on sidewalks and in parks. The city spent this money on all types of efforts, like putting porta-potties and hand-washing stations outdoors, delivering meals and hygiene kits, and also on clearing encampments and moving people to temporary shelters. And still, the number of people in their cars, on the streets, and in tent encampments like the one at Union Point would grow. Over this past decade, the number of homeless people in Oakland has more than doubled. What Eddie didn't know back when he arrived at Union Point Park barefoot was that one day, he and his neighbors, people with everything they owned packed into a car or a tent, would come together and come up with a better way to get themselves out of tent encampments, off of sidewalks. Together, they had this idea that if they had their own piece of land where they could set their own rules, they could manage themselves without city workers calling the shots. It could save the city money and headaches, and it could give the residents of Union Point Park something that people with homes have, the power to make their own decisions about how they'd live. It was an experiment, something the city had never tried. And if it worked, the folks at Union Point believed they'd set an example, a model that would help other homeless people across the state. When I heard about this small group of homeless people, so adamant on being, you know, captains of their own ship, I wanted to know who they were. So I started to hang around. Over the course of a year, I'd see them fight for this radical experiment.
So we was holding these shields like, go ahead, try to come through because we're not letting you in.
They were not prepared for that level of resistance.
I'd see them win.
And then, all of a sudden, all the public works people started leaving. By the grace of God, we did it.
There was someone who came to us with a model for something that we were already asking for. I was very much elated.
And I'd see them build.
One opportunity the city has given us, and if we make this little community here work, then they're going to expand it.
It's an incredible parcel of land, and that fight over how that land would be used really galvanized this movement, public land for public good.
What if it was made to fail?
We're dealing with trauma of transitioning from survival mode on the streets, and then we got to layer on top of this like weird political football. You know, it's like throwing a grenade in a pile of wood.
I cannot speak what's going to happen.
It's not going to stop here. This is just the beginning.
From KQED's Snap Studios, I'm Shayna Sheely. This is A Tiny Plot, Chapter 1, The Barricade. Before this fight for something better, before the characters in this story knew each other at all, there was Eddie at the park. And when more and more homeless people joined him there, they gave him the title of Founding Father and started calling him Papa Eddie. And then, those people brought more people. Friends and girlfriends, husbands and kids.
People are staying like everywhere.
Mustache Mike is a skinny white guy, wiry. He wears a Star of David necklace. He came to the park with his girlfriend Rachel after their group house got condemned. They set up their tent behind a bush near the bathroom. People had all sorts of tents here at the park.
Full-size tents where you can walk inside, small ones where you can just barely crawl inside and just sleep too. We built our own structures.
Mustache Mike built out his tent from materials he found around the park.
I used a tarp, a sail from a boat, and a rubber a mat from like a rubber pool liner, and that stayed dry all winter. Because if your sleeping area gets wet, you're through. You know, you got to have a dry sleeping area because cold is okay, but cold and wet, no good. You get sick, you know, real quick.
At night, Mustache Mike would share cans of sauce and vegetables he'd found with other people sleeping at the park.
It was very cool, you know. It was almost like picnicking or stuff like that, but because everybody knew each other, so that was a big deal, you know, good thing.
When people described Union Point Park to me, it didn't always sound like they were talking about a tent encampment.
Sometimes at night, when the sun's setting in the summer, you'd forget where you were. You think you're in paradise almost, you know?
The people camping here would hear the clink of sailboats as they bobbed up and down with the tide.
It's beautiful right by the water. It's like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. I liked it. There, that's one thing I like, is the sunset.
Oh my gosh, you're at the spot on the bay where you're across the waterway from Alameda. And if you look down the waterway...
There were so many people I talked to who lived at the park. I got to know a few of them pretty well, like this guy Matt. His orange hair and freckles, and he's in his late 30s. Years ago, he was actually student body president of Berkeley City College. And then he was a DJ. And then the pandemic happened and DJ gigs stopped, and so he couldn't casually crash on friends' couches anymore. And then, all of a sudden, he had nowhere to go. After the break, we'll hear how more people landed at Union Point Park and started calling it home. I'm your host, Shayna Sheely. Stay tuned. Welcome back to A Tiny Plot, Chapter 1, The Barricade. When we left off, Matt had just arrived at the park. It was during the start of the COVID pandemic, and he found himself with nowhere else to go.
I sort of showed up there with my tent one day and just kind of like poking around, just kind of, and I just sort of started setting it up. It was a mess. I would say like ramshackled dwelling places, and I bought these foam panels, and I built myself like a little tiny house out of foam. The other people in my neighbors would say, like, said I had the mansion on the block.
He always invited neighbors into his styrofoam mansion during storms. And in return, his neighbors helped him stay sober and focused. They tried to keep him away from an ex who they saw as a bad influence.
And so, real quick, we became kind of like family. So, and we fight like family, too.
This was what a lot of people kept telling me about their stays at the park.
There is a lot of love in the community. There is, really. It's like a unity thing. You know, it's like having a family. You know what I'm saying? And being away from your family for so long, and you miss the family feeling. Oh, what I love about you, Point. Oh, my God. It was the, it was just seeing all the different types of people, black, white, Mexican, whatever. It was just, and everyone got along.
What started as one tent became dozens of makeshift homes. There were tarps and trucks and styrofoam huts. Probably over 30 people, some said as many as 50, all living together at Union Point Park.
2.5 years into the park, that's when the rats started coming.
With more and more people, trash was piling up.
One time I was sleeping, I'm like this. And my hand, I felt a paw on me. But I'm like, hey, that's too little. Oh, God.
A rat?
Yeah, it was a rat in my tent.
They was not rats. They was like little mini chihuahuas.
Enter Deanna Riley. She's 45 years old, a white lady with blonde hair and lots of tattoos. Stars all the way up her arm in memory of her grandma Betty. A heart on her ankle for her stepdad. Tinkerbell on her back, because she likes Tinkerbell. When she first came to the park to see her sister, she thought it would be for a short visit. It was at the height of the rat infestation.
It was nothing but rats, rats everywhere. Them rats was on top of their fucking roof of the tent. I'm like, they're coming in, guys. They are coming in. I gotta go.
But Deanna didn't really have anywhere else to go. When her husband died, she and her kids lost their Section 8 voucher. She didn't have the money to pay rent, so she started living in her car. And then she ended up parking at Union Point one night after hanging out with her sisters, who already lived there. She cuddled her dogs to sleep in the back seat. And she woke up in the lot, morning after morning, until she started to call the place home.
I got a tent. Somebody just gave it to me.
Really?
Burgundy and beige.
She took me there to show me where she set up her tents at the park.
I had a tent here. I had a tent right here.
All six of them.
Then we had a tent right here.
The one tent escalated into many tents.
I had to have one for my bathtub.
Your bathtub had its own tent?
Yeah.
And how'd you get hot water in it?
Boil it.
You had like a little stove?
Like propane? Mm-hmm. I had one of those. And I used to just put big pots of water on.
How often did you take a bath?
Every other day if I wanted, or every day. I just didn't wash my hair every day because it's not good for our hair.
What were your other tents for? You had six. One for your bathtub,
one for your clothes. One for just a girl's spot if we wanted to go ahead and just be girls, because I had a lot of nieces out there too. So I would make sure that they was having fun, and instead of being bored or just sitting in a tent looking like, man, or too embarrassed to come out, mm-hmm. I'd say, hey, everything happens for a reason in life. Don't never be shy about coming out in your situation, because nobody knows your situation. Nobody knows what you're going through.
Deanna's son and daughter, Hazel and Dupree, eventually joined her at the park. And then her son, Kendrick. He brought his kid with him. Deanna babysat her own grandkids and took care of others, too.
I have one daughter biologically and hundreds of daughters. Whoever I come in contact with, I'm always mom to them.
When Deanna learned that rats don't like the smell of mint, she went out and bought strong-smelling plants.
Spearmint and peppermint.
If Eddie was the founding father of Union Point Park, Deanna was the mother. Grown adults at the park actually started to call her mom, or Mama D. And Mama D was a force.
I cleaned the bathrooms morning and night. When my sisters would go to work in the morning, they would have a clean bathroom to get up to, brush their teeth and go use the bathroom, get dressed, and head out to work. When they come home, clean bathrooms so they could go in there, change their clothes, put their pajamas on, and we could sit down and have a conversation for a minute, and then they go to sleep.
People who know her told me she cleaned constantly and commanded others to clean up too. After Mama D surrounded tents with peppermint, she picked up needles and scrubbed the walls of the park's public bathroom stalls.
The graffiti is what really pissed me off. So I went and spent my own money to buy paint, just touch up the paint with the graffiti off the walls, and put some little whale creature, whatever it was, from the dollar store. But it was stickers on the wall to make it look appropriate.
This core group of people, Mama D, Papa Eddie, Matt, they built systems to try to keep themselves healthy and safe.
We actually had people, our own people, going around and doing security, riding around on bikes at night, just checking everything out, making sure everything's cool, you know, no weirdos are around.
One time, in the middle of the night, a woman ran up to Mama D's tent.
Hey, there's a girl getting beaten up in the bathroom. We need to help her. I say, oh, you couldn't have told a guy? Come on, Deanna. And the man is literally beating a woman. I said, okay. I said, Cardi, come on. Get him.
Mama D let her dog Cardi loose.
That man, I ain't seen somebody just so fast into their car.
After that, they developed a safety call.
We had a calling to where if somebody's being harmed and whoever sees it, they yell out, Marco. And then whoever hears it would have to yell, Polo. And if they hear that Polo, they know somebody's coming to help. Whoever made the call. And our call would say something else and let them know we're coming. So that made a lot of the stuff stop happening.
But not all the stuff. Some people living in the park were using drugs and drinking. And they were exposed, living in a public park. Anyone who wanted could walk through their home.
John coming in with prostitutes and beating them up in the bathroom because they didn't do their job right or something.
All of this cleaning and planting mint to get rid of rats and Mama D's Marco Polo system was useful. But it wasn't enough. The problems were overwhelming. The park was not a safe place. In the first 3 years Mama D was at the park, boat owners using the marina and parkgoers and residents reported over 215 violent incidents at Union Point Park. The first one Mama D remembers was when a man was injured in a hatchet attack. A month later, a public bathroom stall was set on fire. Another man was beaten with a baseball bat. There were four separate murders in the parking lot in just 1 year.
It's been the source of constant complaints about filth and crime.
People in Oakland were talking about what a disaster the park was becoming. Even Oakland Parks and Recreation gave their own park a score of F, completely unusable. It was the only park in the city to get that score.
Well, several boat owners are calling an East Bay marina a lawless harbor where homeless people are threatening boaters and breaking into their bathrooms. Now they're calling on the city of Oakland to do something about it. Here's
NBC. Certain areas of the Bay Area shoreline are protected by a government conservation group. It's called the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And this agency started to get complaints about all these homeless people living at the park by the water. This conservation agency told the city of Oakland to clear them out.
Garbage trucks moved in on the mattresses, the mounds of garbage at Union Point Park along the Embarcadero in Oakland.
So the city did start cleaning Union Point Park. It was mostly an annoyance for Mama D and Papa Eddie and everyone else. But it was not a serious threat to their community.
The yellow tag meant you move your stuff and then come back to your spot after they clean. Mm-hmm. Red tag, you had to get out of there. A green means they just looked at your stuff and it's okay. And then they start coming around more often.
Could this be the beginning of a turning point? Many people certainly hope so.
Some people did leave, but they often came back. This went on for 2 years.
It appears to be a problem that has neither any solution, resolution, or endgame. I don't think we have either in this town or any other town any real idea of how to handle it at this point.
Yeah, ongoing issue. All right, Tom Baker.
And then, all of a sudden, this back and forth between the city and the people of Union Point Park came to an end. The conservation agency in charge of the Bay Shoreline gave the city a dire ultimatum, a cease and desist order. We got a copy of it. It ordered the city to close the encampment for good in order to protect the shoreline, to make it more usable for the rest of the public. Or the city would have to pay a fine of $6,000 per day each day that people stayed there, indefinitely.
Well, let's put it this way. $6,000 a day. That's a lot of money.
That was October of 2020. The already squeezed for money city of Oakland, whose budget deficit was already in the hundreds of millions, had just a few months and a very expensive problem. A problem that would involve the fates of lots of people. More after the break. Keep listening for a very unexpected turn of events. Welcome back to A Tiny Plot. You're listening to Chapter 1, The Barricade. I'm your host, Shayna Sheely. When we left off, the city of Oakland had a very expensive problem and a very short time to resolve it.
So we had him by the balls, kind of.
Matt, the former DJ, the guy who had been student body president in college, he surveyed the situation. $6,000 a night for each night they stayed at Union Point. That's over $2 million a year. And Matt realized that he and his community had leverage. With so much money at stake, the city would need them to leave the park and might just be desperate enough to offer them some kind of compensation, some kind of deal. So when Matt saw final cleanup notices posted all over the park, he didn't see threats to disperse and disband. Instead, he saw a reason to rally. Matt gathered everyone under a pop-up tent, and they made a plan together.
To stay, fight, and negotiate.
To negotiate for some kind of offer from the city on their own terms. This idea would plant the seed for the experiment. Again, an experiment with potential to change the future for these homeless people and others in the city too.
We was a family. We was a community that wouldn't let nobody come in and take that from us.
Days before the eviction deadline, Mama D collected cardboard to make signs. Matt strung these multicolored string lights in his pop-up tent and turned it into a center of operations. Activists swarmed the park to help organize residents to resist. Some came with steaming boxes of pizzas. Others brought bottled water.
And some days we would have like three different people show up and there would be like way too much food. So that was great.
The group began building their own system of governance. First, they held elections.
We had put Matt to be our president.
Matt, he knows how to talk to the police and all that, you know, and the legal things to say and whatnot. He used to do a lot of underground parties, like rave parties and stuff.
Student body president Matt was now Union Point President Matt. And when the homelessness administrator of Oakland showed up at the park the week of the eviction, Matt decided to try and talk to him. Dariel Dunstan. He had been working on homelessness for the city of Oakland for a few years. When Dariel first got there, he saw what everyone sees on the surface.
Piles of trash, human feces, inoperable vehicles, makeshift structures.
But Dariel quickly realized what was going on beyond the trash piles.
They seemed to already have identified who the leaders in the groups were. They seemed to have a certain level of respect for one another. So big picture, I am thinking of solutions that could help understanding that I can't wave a magic wand and just fix it, but wanting to just help.
The city has this policy that they must offer some sort of shelter to people when they clear them from an encampment. So Dariel made the standard offer to President Matt and the folks at Union Point Park. He said the city could move them into their community cabins. It's the city's flagship temporary homelessness site. They wouldn't live in tents anymore. Instead, they'd live in 9-by-12-foot sheds. Two people per shed. But it seemed like a lot of people were wary of this offer, including activists who were there at the park.
I'm an organizer with the United Front Against Displacement. Right now, we are at Union Point Park, right outside of the encampment. But one thing about the tough sheds is that a lot of folks don't like it. Like, it's not dignified housing.
There was no running water at the sites. No real place to cook. They might have to bunk up with strangers, two to a shed. Plus, according to a performance audit on the city's homelessness services, nearly half of the people who move there end up back on the street, not in permanent housing. The heart of the issue, though?
There's all these rules, and that just runs counter to a lot of people's, like, strong desire to have a certain degree of freedom in their life.
There can be strict policies around visitors and when you can come and when you can go. President Matt told Darielle no. His styrofoam hut was better than losing his autonomy to live in a shed. The residents at Union Point Park refused the community cabin's offer. They refused the city's standard treatment of homeless people. This move, rejecting their offer, that wasn't what set the Union Point group apart from the 500 or so homeless encampments that the city of Oakland had dispersed over these past 2 years. Other groups rejected similar offers because most wanted something better. There were two things that set this situation apart from other tent encampments being swept up. One, the city was under the pressure of a $6,000 daily fine if the group didn't leave the park. And two, in this moment, the group at Union Point was organized. They had dozens of activists and volunteers backing them up. And in the evenings, the group would gather at the illuminated pop-up tent and talk about the kind of housing they actually wanted to live in.
Running water.
Showers and a bathroom.
A parcel for 3 to 5 years.
Weekly trash pickup. A tiny house community of our own.
And we don't want to go without each other.
Most importantly,
a certain level of autonomy.
The group wanted to write their own rules, decide who could visit their community, what amenities they'd have, how security would work. And they were ready to fight for it.
Everybody came together as one community. Hmm. You want to think twice before coming to Union Point and messing with somebody, because you're not going to only mess with that one person. You're going to mess with everybody here.
That was crazy. They were not prepared for that level of resistance.
The city's final cleanup notice, it said they'd start evicting people from Union Point on February 9th, 2021.
And they were like, okay, now we have 4 days. Now's the push time.
A big group of volunteers arrived to the point.
They was teaching us how to defend ourselves with the armor gear and hold our positions.
Armor gear?
Like how they have their
shields.
Their shields and stuff when...
Did you actually have shields?
Yeah, we had shields, huh?
What, did they give them to you?
No, we know how to make them though now, yeah. Huh? You get some thick wood, mm-hmm. that you can't bust. Because if you hit a thin piece of wood, you're just going to go straight through it. But you get some thick wood, you get some leather straps like, or whatever kind of straps you want.
The idea was to shield what was left of the encampment from the city cleanup crews.
So that way we can be able to stop them from coming in.
They trained with two people per shield.
So we was holding these shields like, go ahead, try to come through because we're not letting you in. It, just having that power with that shield kind of made us a little bit more stronger to be able to do what we have to do to, because they see we're not going to back down. The shields was awesome. It was just a bunch of people.
The day before the scheduled cleanup, President Matt took out his laptop and looked up California's OSHA standards. He told me he found a guideline warning employees at the Department of Public Works about lifting items more than 50 pounds. And he came up with an idea.
It was definitely my idea.
A barricade around the encampment built with items heavier than 50 pounds.
There was just a couple of us who went around and collected stuff, anything we could find in the area, and we just piled it up in a big heap.
Garbage bags full of garbage.
Dishwasher that someone had thrown out.
Piles of dirt.
The refrigerator, a mattress.
Seats, anything to slow down their progress.
Bed frames and lions, tigers, and bears.
The residents stayed up through the night building the barricade. By the next morning, outsiders had arrived. Activists, volunteers, journalists.
So can you tell me who you are and where we are?
I'm Deanna Riley. We're at Union Point Park. They're trying to put us out with nowhere else to go. No reprieve zone.
The first public works truck rolled in early in the morning. There were cop cars, too. Some residents left the park because they were worried about a confrontation. Others left for housing offered by the city and never came back. But a bunch of them stayed to fight.
Good, good. We're ready. We're ready. You guys aren't coming in here today.
Volunteers handed out coffee and donuts. One guy sat at a broken-down piano that had become part of the barricade and played. Others stood with the residents around the barricade, shouting,
"Hell no, we won't go." When I say we had people there supporting us, we had people honking, we had people with signs. We need adequate housing.
Mama D told me that the city of Oakland was now faced with a heavy wall of junk, and they were running out of time. Soon, they'd have to start paying a lot of money every day.
Given the action that the other state agency was taking against the city, our hands were tied and we had to do something.
Days into the standoff, the city homelessness administrator, Dariel, showed up with a couple city employees and a single garbage truck.
Dariel was in a black sweatsuit with a hoodie, you know, covered up.
The mound of things piled up was over 5 feet tall.
And I walked over and sat on the barricade.
Matt sat down on a mattress, balanced on top of the barricade. Dariel had been quietly observing Matt and the others for a few days, and he had an idea. There was this homelessness intervention model called co-governance that had been floating around. Some students at UC Berkeley had written a paper about it, and Dariel had been talking about it with other city employees for months. He'd even studied how it was implemented in other cities, Seattle and Eugene. The key features of co-governance are these resident-led agreements. Agreements about how homeless people will live together in community, like how they'll pick their leaders and make their own rules. And Dariel thought that this group might be the perfect one to pilot this co-governance idea in Oakland because they were already organized. They already had leaders.
Matt had all of the makings of being an effective leader. He could build things from, you know, wood and piping. You need a person like that if you're trying to create a village.
And then Dariel made a move that surprised everyone. He walked from the truck towards the barricade, looked up at President Matt, and climbed the pile of junk to the top. He sat down next to Matt, and the two chatted.
When it came to a head with me and Dariel on the barricade is when, like, he basically made the concession. He cited the co-governed model, which sort of addressed the concerns that we had had.
Dariel told Matt that under co-governance, city officials would work with the Union Point group to create a kind of village where residents wouldn't be told what their rules and rights were, but they would decide on them together with the city. Dariel presented the model as an experiment, one that could potentially help homeless people across Oakland. President Matt liked the sound of that.
I was very much elated. There was someone who came to us with a model for something that we were already asking for. So it really seemed very positive, like there was a light at the end of the tunnel.
And right there, on a busted mattress on top of a barricade, President Matt accepted the idea under certain terms. He wanted a parcel of land for 3 to 5 years, toilets, regular trash pickup, water hookups, electrical hookups, and autonomy for the group to make their own choices.
When Matt and Dario shook hands, we could tell. It was like, yes, something is about to happen for us.
No one really knew what was going on until Matt announced to the protesters that the city was ready to negotiate.
There was like so much like energy and emotion swept up into it. It was a charged moment, but basically we liked what he had to offer.
Darielle told Matt that if this group agreed to leave Union Point Park, he'd advocate for the city to work with them to build this community he was asking for. He'd pause the eviction until the group had time to pack their things into storage containers. And while they worked out the details of this new communal home, the city would pay for residents to stay in motel rooms.
Well, that handshake was, the city is going to continue to work with you in this community to identify a parcel of land that you all can remain in community and possibly implement a co-governed encampment.
It was an offer made under duress. The city didn't want to pay $6,000 a night to the Shoreline Protection Agency.
That wasn't a handshake to say that this deal is done. It was a handshake to say that the city will continue to work with you all in good faith.
Darielle made his way down the barricade and waved off the dump truck. And the work crews backed away.
Then, all of a sudden, all the public works people started leaving. By the grace of God, we did it.
Finally, after over 2 years of struggle between the city and park residents, a deal had been reached that all sides seemed pleased with.
We could really see ourselves doing this in Oakland, becoming the first, being able to have it done and succeed.
This was day one. An experiment in co-governance. It was an experiment that would test the commitments of this group and of city staff trying to figure out how to address the vast homelessness crisis here. This experiment started here, on a barricade made of trash.
What you have is the power to be your own security. Make sure your community stays clean. Make sure you're getting the resources that you need to build or whatever it is that you want to accomplish within your co-governancy. It was like, man, we did something. We accomplished something. Now let's see how much further we could go.
You just heard the very first episode of A Tiny Plot. There's more, 5 chapters total. Over the next few weeks, we'll be releasing episodes on the Snap Judgment feed on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Chapter 2 is dropping in just a few days, here in the Snap Judgment feed. You don't want to miss it.
It was crazy.
I think it was traumatic for a lot of people.
He had 2 of them. You know, the little things that munch everything and rips it to shreds and stuffs it in the back of the garbage truck.
I'm your host, Shayna Sheely. And I really want to thank everyone who worked on this show. First, the entire cast from Union Point Park. Thank you for letting me into your world. And second, the whole team at Snap Studios. Thank you. The series was edited by Anna Sussman and Mark Ristich. Original music by Renzo Gorio. Extra special thanks to Jen Chen, Catherine Winter, the City of Oakland, Sweetie at the Travel Inn, Ryan Finnegan, Will Kraft, J.P. Dobrin, Thomas Browns, Suki Lewis, Alistair Boone and the Street Spirit, and KQED Legal. Engineering by Pat Masidi Miller. Our director of production is Marissa Dodge. And our executive producers are Glenn Washington and Mark Ristich.
Thank you for listening to A Tiny Plot here on Snap Judgment. Big thanks as well to everyone on the program. We appreciate you. No Snap Studios content may be used for training, testing, or developing machine learning or AI systems without prior written permission on Team Snap. The union represented producers, artists, editors, and engineers are members of the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, Communications Workers of America, AFL-CIO Local 51, And this is not the news. No way is this the news, because this is A Tiny Plot, a brand new epic series from KQED's Snap Studios. The story has just begun. And of course, this is PRN.